Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the A-List with me, Jennifer Lindsay. Every week, we speak with an influencer to see what makes them tick. And today, Wednesday, February 23rd, 2011, I am delighted to welcome Augie Ray, who until recently was a senior analyst for Forrester Research in the Interactive division, and is now leaving that role to become the senior analyst for, and actually this is a pretty cool title, he's the future executive director of community and collaboration for USAA. As you may remember, Augie first joined the A-List, back in 2009. We had him on, and he actually was, I think, one of my first guests. He has a blog called Experience the Blog, and actually on the blog he talks about, that was one of the first places he and one of the things I love about Augie is that he actually talked about the transition and what it's going to mean to USAA, so hopefully we'll be able to go a little bit deeper for folks who've already seen him write about it. But for those that don't know, his blog is called Experience the Blog, so Experience colon the blog. And on it, he talks about, very exciting, kind of ways to think about things. And what I love about Augie's posts is that they're very well sourced. So I consider him a really, really good blogger and think a lot of him. Let's see if we have him on the line now. Augie, are you with us?
I am. Sorry for being a minute late here. My apologies.
No problem. So I think it's 2 cross-country moves for you in 15 months. Is that right?
Yeah, and actually even one move within the Bay Area in that period.
That's
true. We first settled in the San Mateo and then moved to the city. So we are getting a little tired of moving, my wife and I.
And you guys make a great pair, and that's one of the things I love about you is that you're so human and accessible. I guess we'll start out, obviously you had a very, what I think a lot of people, especially in this industry, consider a very key role at, a major analyst firm, research firm, Forrester Research. What I wonder is how much people have sort of, in terms of your profile, do you feel like it's changed in any way? You've amazingly stayed the same guy, your predecessor to some extent in that role or a similar role. Jeremiah O. Yang has gone on to Altimeter Group. And I find is increasingly less accessible in terms of, and some people have to do this. I'm only doing things for pay and not really sharing their views as much. Yet, when your experience, the blog came back, the first thing you did was talk about this transition and so what I feel from you is that you're still the same guy and, not much has changed. So tell me a little bit about that, about what it was like to kind of have that role, and did you feel sort of, like you were in this exalted place and people kind of looked at you a little bit differently?
Well, first of all, thank you for saying that you think I'm still the same guy. I mean, I really did try to hold on to that. I'll tell you that being an analyst is kind of a heady experience, and I did feel as if the role that I was in at Forrester changed the awareness of me and the opportunities I had to engage with others. So I was a managing director at a mid-sized agency in Milwaukee and had a fairly successful blog, was hired by Forrester and sort of instantaneously, because Forrester has such influence and it imparts that influence onto its analysts, became somebody who had a bigger voice. I was asked to speak at large events. My blog got greater readership within the Forrester blog platform. Certainly the reports that I wrote were pretty widely read within our client organizations. And then I had opportunities to connect with a lot of people. some of the experiences that I really have enjoyed are, getting to know some of the great minds at places like Lithium and Bizarre Voice and Facebook and Twitter, Intelligent, and all these great companies that are in the Bay Area and around the country. And there are aspects of that that I'm certainly going to miss as I move into my new role at USAA. But every job has sort of its pluses and minuses. And so the psychic benefits of being an analyst was one of the pluses, a lot of attention. Analysts do get a lot of praise, and I think over time that's what causes some of them to begin to build up that ego, and maybe deservedly so. I don't mean that in a critical sense. I really did come into this role purposely deciding to hold on to my Midwestern roots, and I joke that my wife helps keep me humble by, reminding me that I'm not all that. But it is a kind of job where, over time, a lot of people tell you how brilliant you are constantly, and maybe you are, maybe you aren't. To the extent to which you buy into that, I guess, affects the persona that you bring to your job and to your social media efforts.
Well, I certainly thank you. Being chairing the programming committee, for Social Media Club, in the Bay Area, you've added so much great thought leadership and actual case studies and practical examples to real events that real people can go to, and just interacting with them with that same sort of demeanor. Because one thing that we at Social Media Club, and especially I try to do with events, is, we never know if we're going to get, people that are highly experienced and know social media really well. But, one thing I'm always aware of is that the statistic and the number of small businesses, especially with this government and the encouragement and encouraging of entrepreneurship, and in the tech sector, you never know who the next person on the block is. So, I think it behooves us to stay very open to the next big thing. I thought of that when I watched The Social Network. I don't know if that occurred to you at any point, where, Mark Zuckerberg, the personification as given by Jesse Eisenberg, was, to Harvard, you should be thanking me. Sometimes I think we forget, in terms of how I took that point, I took it probably a little bit differently than most audiences, and it's that, sometimes we forget that maybe we're not the innovators, that we have to stay open to the new people, the new kids on the block, and embrace them. Otherwise, they cipher off, and we're not sharing the knowledge properly, I guess. But you've always done that, and I thank you for that. So I want to make sure I get to thank you before you leave.
I'm not dying. I just want to point out I'm still going to be available.
No, I know, but having you, being able to email you and say, "Oh, can you be here on the 15th?" Or whatever. You've been fabulous about making yourself available.
Yeah, it'll be a little harder to meet you somewhere in Soma at a moment's notice. But, it's interesting, though, that one of the things, I'm going to be speaking on a panel at South by Southwest at a panel called Linguistic Mythbusters, about some of the language of the web that those of us in the panel would like to do away with. And one of the things I'm actually going to be mentioning, and you use this, and I understand the vein that you used it, but I think we ought to stop talking about the next big thing all the time. The next big thing, for a couple of reasons. First of all, what's interesting to me is when you think about it, the web was the next big thing, and it took 15 years for social media to come along. And, here we are a couple of years in the social media era, and people are like, "Well, what's the next big thing?" And the thing I tell my clients all the time at Forrester is that social media is the next big thing. Companies are still figuring it out. When you think about where we were 4 years into the web era, it was 1999, and companies thought that they were really on top of this web thing because they'd launched their websites. And then, the next 10 years came along and changed everything about the web experience. And it changed consumer expectations. It changed the way companies, built their products, the way they serviced their customers. And so we're 4 years into the social media era, and it has not changed everything it's going to change. It has not challenged everything that social media is going to challenge. So we're going to see continued development, and it's going to take some time for the quote-unquote next big thing. The other thing that I think is interesting about the next big thing is people, when they say that, sometimes act as if, you know, it comes along and then it's instantaneously obvious to everyone that it is the next big thing.
Yeah,
And
that's a very good point.
You know, not the way it works at all. I mean, you know, even now there are people who think that social media is exaggerated, and, you know, the power of social media is exaggerated, and they're incorrect, and there are people who believe in the power of social media. But, you know, the way the next big thing happens is that it starts as the next small thing, and it picks up steam, and it picks up doubters, and eventually we all stand back and look back, you know, 2-3 years ago and say, wow, that was the next big thing, wasn't it? So, you know, I sometimes think that we're always searching for this thing that will plop into our laps and you know, just explode on us with obviousness. And I don't think that's the way it's going to work at all.
Well, I mean, you know, some obvious observations are sort of, you know, listening to your customers. Social media has allowed people at large corporations, you know, and small ones, the companies of any size, to actually listen to their customers, interact, and create a feedback loop, you know, within product, within customer service, within whatever the channels are of their organization, hopefully for the greater good. So, I mean, that's certainly something, you know, people talking to companies about their product because they're customers, because they might want to be a customer. Certainly that was nothing new, but being able to harness the power of that through these channels is something, you know, that sort of is new, and embracing that is more of the culture shift that makes it a big thing as opposed to it actually in and of itself being even a new concept.
No, and that's, you know, you're absolutely right. I mean, that's the thing about the next big thing, is that you have to look for the culture shifts, not the technology. You know, I think back about 4 years ago, 5 years ago, when people were saying that virtual worlds and Second Life were the next big thing. But, you know, they while they attracted some attention and some, you know, Time magazine covers and a little bit of marketer money, it never represented a culture shift. Then social media comes along and it, you know, truly represents a culture shift. The thing we still need to figure out, though, is, you know, we need to listen and we need to respond. And I think those of us in social media and increasingly those of us outside of social media recognize it. But I also think those of us in social media can overstate the case a little bit. And I want to be careful about this because I certainly think listening matters and sentiment matters. But there's a sense that, you know, every consumer has to be responded to or addressed and that every complaint is equally important. And I just don't think that's, in fact, the case. And I think we're going to build a body of knowledge here in the coming years that will help us to guide the level of responsiveness, the speed of responsiveness. And it's not just going to be a consumer's clout. You know, I look at, for instance, a couple of weeks back, as your listeners probably will remember, Kenneth Cole got caught in a firestorm of controversy, and not just the brand, but in fact, the guy himself who made a tweet that made a light of the situation in Egypt and how people were storming the streets because they must be excited about Kenneth Cole's new line of clothing. And, you know, as we all know, that generated a tremendous amount of blog criticism, a tremendous amount of tweeted criticism. But at the end of the day, the question I've got is, did all of that decrease sales? Did it decrease brand loyalty in Kenneth Cole or not? And my guess is that it didn't. And so, you know, we have this tendency of very quickly tossing every situation like that into the same category and calling it a social media disaster. And, you know, no one would argue that Kenneth Cole wasn't being pretty clumsy. But at the end of the day, the question is, was this truly a disaster or was it a lot of tempest in a teapot that went away? And at the end of the day, if you went and looked at Kenneth Cole on Facebook, what you'd find is that a lot of his fans were very quick to defend him and tell people to back off and it was just a joke and, you know, they're taking it too seriously. So it very well may be that while unplanned, or as some people have sort of intimated, maybe planned, maybe the whole Kenneth Cole situation, despite being called a disaster by so many folks, a PR disaster, wasn't even that much a disaster. Maybe it was even a benefit. So anyways, I mean, it goes to show you, I don't offer that to make an argument for that people shouldn't, the brand shouldn't listen or they shouldn't respond, or that every situation is something we can make light of. Clearly, I feel differently than that, but I use it as a situation to show how little we actually really know about social media and about the way attitudes are changed yet, and to being able to recognize what is really important from what is really not important. And, you know, one of the first things you and I ever spoke about, Jennifer, was an interesting situation because I wrote a blog post and used snakes on a plane as an example, if I remember our first conversation.
Yes, you did.
And, here was a lot of positive sentiment, too. It's the opposite of the Kenneth Cole situation. Snakes on a Plane, before the movie came out, generated all this very positive sentiment, positive engagement. And it also made the cover of magazines, and people said, this is the new way of doing things. And then the movie came out, and it crashed and burned. It was one of the biggest disappointments of the year. So that's an example of where a lot of positive sentiment didn't actually help the brand.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I call myself something a little bit different, you know, in my job, as I call myself a social media management consultant, because 9 times out of 10, when I go to a company, you know, I'm looking to train them and leave, you know, because I think there was a series of podcasts I did, and I think Andy Beal was sort of the, you know, from Marketing Profs and Tracker, was one of the final people that said, you know, Dell Outlet is a great case study for these reasons. And I thought, you know, I need to reach out to Dell and get them on and talk about this. And so I, you know, in the great wisdom of Richard at Dell, which is his handle on Twitter, was fantastic. And he's so open, and he's another wonderfully open, fabulous person that I just love. And I said, you know, Richard, is this, you know, was Dell Outlet this great strategy? People talk about it being, you know, this fabulous strategy and a case study already. And at that time, it was brand new in terms of the amount of sales it was even generating, at least in this country. And they've since localized it to others. And he said, you know, look, we never know when we're going to have refurbished units or when we're going to have whatever. So we looked around and we said, what tools are available? Twitter's real time. Let's pair up Twitter with our Dell Outlet. We can often update Twitter quicker than we can update, you know, our homepage, or know what to put where or organize it, you know, sort of programmatically. You know, the landing page, and we can, you know, let people know what these offers are. And it was matching the right channel to the right business case. And, you know, sort of, you know, as we talked further, there was that sort of realization that, you know, it can be that simple, where if you know your stuff and you know the basic tools that are out there, and I think, you know, a lot of brands and even small companies feel pretty pressured to be on Twitter and Facebook these days. And that's one where, you know, again, looking at the business case and then looking at the tool is really key. And the other thing, you know, as Richard and I spoke more was, you know, I said, you know, you've been doing social media for quite some time, and we talked about that in the show. But the other thing was just how he said, you know, it kind of just became part of my job. And the great thing about Richard is, you know, I don't know how old he is, but whatever, it was that attitude of just, you know, I have to be nimble, it's what I do, is something that's so key. And attitude shifting, again, like you said before, I think is so key. You know, it's the culture shift within organizations, and to whatever extent we can help that happen is so important and vital to determining what the future is, what the next best thing is, or, you know, I'm not going to say the next big thing, but maybe the next best thing.
Yeah, I'll say that I've never been very fond of the Dell Outlet example as a case study. And I know why people...
It's really not. If you talk to Richard, it's not.
Yeah. Here's a situation where you know, somebody proves that, you know, social media makes money, and so everyone hooked onto it. It made 1,000 blogs, and I recognize why people are excited to demonstrate that. But at the end of the day, as you point out, it wasn't really a strategy. It was a tactic of matching the right channel to the right need. And more than that, you know, the question I have is when you look at, and this is one of the questions I would ask everyone listening to ask themselves every time they see a case study, and they see, you know, the value of a fan is, you know, $359 or whatever some people say they have calculated, or they see that Dell outlet says that they have made so many millions of dollars, is that really new value being created? What we need to be able to show is that social media is creating new value. And to me, Dell outlet is a cannibalization issue. They used to send out emails, they used Twitter, and people migrated to the channel that was quicker and more real time. But, you know, are all those millions of dollars of sales that were created on Dell Outlet new sales? No. I mean, they were sales that probably would have happened through other channels. I always see the same thing when I start getting into this discussion of the value of a Facebook fan, is there are people out there that are adding up the lifetime value of all of the customers in their Facebook group, and they come up with these tremendous numbers. But the thing is that the person who clicks the like button and joins your fan page doesn't have zero lifetime value before they do that. And by clicking the button, they have really not changed their lifetime value that much. And what we have to do as serious social media professionals is begin to recognize what the action of liking and commenting really means to the company. And sometimes, like the Dell outlet, like the value of Facebook fans, I feel like we are grasping for some indefensible sorts of justifications when there are real ones out there. It's just that they are more subtle, they are more complex, they aren't as easily encapsulated as in Dell made $7 million. So that's a great headline, but, you know, you've got to start scratching below the surface to ask, you know, is this really a good strategy?
Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, certainly that was one of the things that you know, he and I spoke about was, you know, is the Dell outlet example, you know, and this was, you know, kind of emerging at the time, and people think of it or have mentioned it as a case study since, and it never really was meant to be. You know, it was not intended that way. Of course, like you said, anytime something makes money, people gravitate towards it, and like you said, you know, there's no way of knowing, at least at this stage, with very easily knowing whether it's just a shift in you know, revenue that could have come to the channel anyway, or a slight increase, you know, because the channel is maybe better than their website at that particular time. But, you know, as we see these technologies be increasingly kind of engulfed into organizations, you know, Twitter's much more used off its own platform than on it. It could be integrated into their own website and potentially be as successful now, you know, as a place to get, you know, all your information about Dell and also research the units, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, it sort of lends itself to that question of, you know, as I was, you know, sort of saying is, you know, ideally, you know, I tell companies, you know, I want to help you figure out who is able to learn this stuff or, you know, already knows it, you know, has high ability to be agile and learn and know these things and take on these roles and then leave. And what that leaves us with is, you know, kind of in my mind, a real change in what the roles will be. And I think this is a question that comes up a lot. And I would imagine as a research analyst, this is something that has come up in terms of, how do I hire? How do I scale for social media? I mean, I see it really as something where there are very specific roles that can be taken inside an organization, and then there's real guidance about very, you know, tactical levels of thinking that may or may not be within the organization that are trainable. The strategy may be something that they need help with, but eventually it becomes part of what people do, and it sort of shifts a bit. I'm wondering what your perspective is on that, because I know one of the conversations that's popped up around Social Media Club is the future of the social media manager. And you have people like Evan Williams who are saying, himself a community manager, that they won't exist in, say, a year.
Yeah, I think they will exist. I think there's always going to be a need for... On the one hand, I'm guilty of using the web as an analogy for social media and how it got adopted and how companies, how it changed corporate culture, and how the companies that succeeded a decade and a half ago and a decade ago are those that adopted not just the technology of the web, but adopted the cultural shift that came with it. at the same time, there are limits to how far you can bring that analogy. And I think social media is going to be something that integrates more deeply into the organization than the web did. And partially because the web is a technology, essentially. And everyone has to be web savvy today. Every company does. We ought to be able to communicate in email. We have to know how to use the web to do our research. So that was important that everyone adopt. But social media really does kind of change the way we communicate, the way decisions are made. You know, you look at the Gap logo situation or the Tropicana. I can't think of the name here. The visual design of their product. You know, these are things that are affecting the way we make business decisions and doing it fairly quickly. And yes, people will argue, and rightly so, that Gap overreacted too quickly. But you know, the point here is that social media isn't just a technology that we implement and forget. It's a way that we now have to live and we have to make decisions. We have to recognize that the way the corporations made decisions 10 or 20 years ago isn't the same as today. We have to bring consumers along with us. We have to work with them. We can't surprise them. To bring it back to the question of actual roles, I think that all those things mean that we are going to see for quite some time, maybe not forever, but for quite some time, expertise. I actually think that there's going to be a need for community managers for years to come. And those community managers are going to be the people that train others and monitor what goes on in the community. They may not be the ones that are responding to everything. You know, we need people who are customer service reps today on the phone who are going to need to be effectively customer service reps in social media venues. Not every one of them will be a quote-unquote community manager. And what the community manager does is help train those people and monitor and give feedback and monitors the community for situations that require more immediate attention and more senior attention. And that isn't something that's going to go away anytime in the future. Now, you know, that said, will we need community managers 10 years from now, or will we have a set of professionals who are able to do all of the things that community and experienced at doing all the things community managers are today? And I think possibly. But even today, 15 years into it, we have people who have web titles. They are responsible for digital marketing. They're responsible for internet customer service. And those jobs didn't go away after 15 years. I don't think anything with social media in terms of the jobs that exist today are going to go away as quickly as a year or two from now either.
It's a very, very good point. And, you know, it transitions actually really well into what is part of your title as you move over to USAA. And I think we should probably start by just letting folks know that haven't read your blog posts and maybe aren't familiar with what USAA does. A lot of us know it's a great organization and very excited for you. So tell us a little bit about USAA and what your role will be as the future executive director of community and collaboration. And I love that collaboration is in there, by the way.
Yeah, it's interesting because to tell you a little bit about USAA, I have to tell you about the journey I took in accepting this position. And as you point out, not everyone will have read my blog post, but I got a call from a recruiter and basically said no, I wasn't willing and ready to leave San Francisco. Certainly was not willing and ready to leave Forrester quite this quickly, and just said no, the job didn't interest me. But they were pretty persistent because of some things I have in my background. And I'm glad they were, because what happened was I began to consider what my post-Forrester route would be. And I love being an analyst, but I really did miss some things, like really getting my hands dirty with the problems that a company has, and being able to see things through to completion. One of the things that Forrester analysts really don't do are engage over the long haul. There are analyst firms, you know, McKinsey will go in and will, you know, put somebody on site for 3 or 6 months at a time. At Forrester, we tend to do more workshops and consulting that's a little briefer. We really help people with the data that I keep saying we, but I think of myself as a Forresterite and will for many years. But we help people with the data that we gather and help them to make the right decisions. And then, as you said earlier about yourself, we train and then we hopefully give our clients a shove in the right direction, and they go off and largely, for the most case, do it themselves. And maybe they'll call us in to help tweak them along the way, but we're not there literally holding their hands through the whole thing.
Yeah.
And And I actually missed that. So, you know, there was this nagging feeling that I really, you know, knew I was going to be leaving Forrester within several years, and that I really wanted to find the right organization to go lead and coordinate social media. And then the more I learned about USAA, the more it occurred to me that maybe this was that opportunity that I was waiting for. And for those of you who don't know USAA, and some do not, and there's a reason for that, and that's because USAA is a financial services firm that provides services to people who serve or have served in the U.S. Armed Forces and their families. It's a very large organization. It's number 132 on the Fortune 500 list. But what really attracted me is that, first of all, community is part of their mission. And has been for years. They really want to embrace the military community, and it's not just something that they bolted on in 2011 because social media has gotten hot. The other thing is that this is a company that gets the consumer experience. And I've written blog posts about this as well, that all the strategy around social media that in the world will not change the outcome if you have at the core a product or a service, in other words, an experience that really doesn't get people talking, doesn't turn them into fans, doesn't turn them into people who have affinity and advocacy that they share in social media. And USAA is that company. In fact, there's an organization that tests the Net Promoter Score of all the companies in the United States, and USAA has the highest Net Promoter Score of any company in the U.S. It beats JetBlue, it beats Trader Joe's, it beats Apple. And so these are the things that began to come together for me where I said, you know, here's a company that gets the experience, that gets customer centricity, that gets community, and, you know, where am I going to find an opportunity to work in such a, you know, to plant the seeds in such a fertile ground. And what's interesting to me is I don't even have to plant the seeds. I mean, so many people who are getting hired into customer, into social media leadership roles today are stepping into companies that are just starting from scratch. They might have a Twitter account. They maybe have a Facebook account, but there's no organized strategy. In this role, I get to work with a team that's already doing it, a bunch of very bright people. Who are doing some very interesting things with blogs, with communities, with Facebook. And so, you know, I don't have to worry about getting an organization up to speed. In fact, I worry about myself getting up to speed with all the exciting things that USAA is doing, which will be job one for me. So I'm very excited about it.
I think it's going to be a great fit, it sounds like. Now, where in the country, So folks have a sense of the human travails because you were at Forrester for, was it 15 months?
15, 16 months, yeah.
So you traveled from the Midwest to the San Francisco area, then moved into San Francisco itself, and now you're moving to the general area is?
It's San Antonio, Texas.
Hey, well, that'll be handy for South by Southwest, at least.
Yeah, I am looking forward to it, although I wish the timing were just a little different because I start the new job on the 7th of March, and then, you know, right away that first weekend, I'm driving to Austin for South by Southwest, and I really would like to, you know, have a little bit more experience at USAA under my belt before I actually go start representing. But I mentioned that great team that I'm going to be working with, and many of them are going to be down there as well. So, in fact, what's funny is my first week, of course, is going to be, as is typical of many large organizations, a lot of orientation. The first opportunity I'm going to have to really get to know some members of my team is going to be in Austin at South by Southwest, which is sort of an interesting way of doing it.
That is very, very interesting. It's maybe, you know, it's maybe atypical, but, you know, certainly being part of the speaking route has been, you know, part of your role at Forrester in terms of the thought leadership that's provided there. You know, one of the things I always think about and you know, you see these great reports that Forrester produces among other analyst firms, and you go, gosh, you know, how do they get from, you know, the original concept and flesh it out? Can you tell us, you know, in terms of, you know, as you transition into your new role at USAA, a little bit what it was like to transition into the role at Forrester initially from mid-sized firm to research analyst. What was that transition like?
Sure. It was interesting to me. First of all, I'll tell you a quick story that, Jennifer, you may know, but one of the ways that I landed the Forrester job was that I had written a blog post that was gently critical of one of the reports that Forrester had written. At the time, I was a Forrester client. They had published a report on sponsored conversations, and it said all the right things. They said you have to follow the rules. You have to make sure that you disclose in a clear and conspicuous manner. But I really had expected Forrester to make a strong stand about pulling out the checkbook and saying that you really shouldn't be paying for blog posts, but there's all sorts of ways to compensate bloggers. You can compensate them with some free products so that they can write from a set of experiences. You can compensate them with access to information, but just don't pull out the checkbook. That seemed inauthentic to me. And Forrester didn't say that. So I wrote a blog post about this. And what was interesting is that Josh Burnoff responded from the Groundswell blog to the constructively critical blog post that I'd written, and so a dialogue began. And then when Jeremiah left, I saw an opportunity to reach back out to some of these people. And so the reason I got on their radar and at least had a shot at the job in the first place was due to having written this blog post. So, this is one, by the way, when we talked earlier about ROI and how nuanced it is, but when I started my blog and dedicated, hundreds, maybe even thousands of hours to it, I didn't do it thinking, hey, I'm going to land a job at Forrester, which, was really a great experience for me. But it happened anyways. And so sometimes when we go into these social media things, and this is whether you're a company or whether you're an individual, the benefits aren't always necessarily really clear. Sometimes they develop.
So
with time.
True.
So when what happened was, and the hiring process, by the way, might be of some interest to some of your listeners, is a really time-consuming one, because what we had to do is go through the normal set of interviews, and there's lots of those, of course. But then to land the job, we had to write a Forrester report. I understand there were two other candidates with me at that point. And so we had to set a topic. We had to state our hypothesis. We were given the Forrester guidelines for style, and we were asked to write a Forrester report. And at that point, they then narrowed the field down and then asked the final two candidates to actually produce a PowerPoint deck and present the report as they would as a Forrester analyst.
What an opportunity.
Yeah, well, it was really exciting. It was, on the one hand, it was just a lot of time. At the same time, this isn't, I have to hold down my old job while making all this happen. It was a lot of time to commit. I feel I have since met the gentleman who didn't get the job. We've developed a bit of a friendship. He's a very nice guy, very capable guy. He's actually, in hindsight, very happy he didn't get the job. He's gone off to do some very interesting things at startups. I, on the other hand, would have sucked at that, what he's doing. I was really happy to get this job. And so, all's well that ends well. But I do have a certain sense of regret for the people who spent just as much time as I did and didn't end up getting it, because it's a very time-consuming situation. So then I was onboarded, and what happened was that report that I had written, as a candidate, became the basis for the first report that I published at Forrester. And what's interesting is that when you hear that, you think, well, he wrote a report that was good enough to get him hired, so it was probably pretty easy to publish that report. And in fact, that was quite a journey. And it goes to show you how seriously Forrester takes the style that they write in. And it's not just a matter of style for branding purposes. It's a matter of style for comprehension and style for easy scanning. And so there was a good 6-week period where this report that was good enough to get me hired suddenly became a very bad Forrester report and needed a lot of attention to be turned into a Forrester report. It was a very eye-opening experience. Another quick story I'll tell you is that Josh Burnoff edited my first report at Forrester. And what's interesting about Josh is that he's not only got this tremendous level of experience, but he also is totally committed to helping others. But he also does it in a way that's very candid, very direct, and you've got to kind of put on your big boy pants, because I got a document back from him, my first edit from him, that had more changes and more comments than I have ever seen inserted into a document. And your first thought is, oh my God, I really suck at this. I'm a new employee, and get this level of feedback back. And in fact, I told Josh when I left that the first two reports that he edited for me were some of the greatest learning experiences I've had in many years. I learned a lot from Josh and really appreciate it. And so, the process is essentially that, is we try to plan it for Forrester reports for a whole year in advance. That's something, truthfully, I struggled with because social media changes so quickly. But you understand the topic areas that you want to cover, and that helps to guide the briefings that you accept from vendors and from companies and agencies. And you develop hypotheses, and then you begin to put down together an outline. Very important step in this process is an outline, because one of the things that those of you who have access to Forrester reports may or may not have noticed is that if you simply pull out your report and read the executive summary and then read the headlines, which you might think in web terms is the H1 and the H2, you should be able to get the whole story of the report, maybe not all the details clearly, but the story of the report just by doing that. So developing the outline becomes very important. The headers are something that they take very seriously. They have to be readable and give information, not just announce what will follow. And then you start writing the report. And depending on the report that you do, it could be something that a single editor takes a look at, or you could just share it with a number of your peers and gather feedback. It's a very strenuous process. It is nowhere near as easy as it might seem from the outside. And one of the things I've came to really appreciate is how very different a Forrester report is from a blog post.
Really? Because your blog posts are one of the things that I always point to in terms of your blog posts on Experience the Blog, and I noticed its big rebrand. It looks really pretty now. Not that it didn't before, but it has a very, very different feel, and I love it. I love that you do such – you have such a great way of, one, as you mentioned before, in terms of your exchange with Josh Burnoff, is that you approach things from a very, this is my point of view, but let's talk about it kind of point of view, in a way that's a little bit more forceful than that. But you certainly are open to certainly present your findings in a way that is very approachable and encourages discussion, which I think is an art form in and of itself, to be honest. And the other thing is that you really do a lot of research in terms of your blog efforts, and which is another thing that I tend to find, being something that's rather rare these days. Part of the reason that I love doing a podcast is because it's like, the example I was talking about where, sort of the third or fourth person used Dell Outlet as an example, and I thought, gosh, are we really blowing this out of proportion? Let's talk to the folks at Dell and, can kind of use this platform to discuss and what the kind of real truths are versus what's perceived. And so I think that's, a real, a starting advantage in a way in terms of the way that you approached your blog. And I'm just curious, kind of as sort of a singular point, kind of within the point of transitioning to, obviously Forrester Research has its own style, as you said, and that takes some getting used to. But in terms of the way that you write your blog and the way that you've sourced material to come up to the conclusions that you do or make kind of the recommendations that you do, things are based on examples, white papers, case studies, links to other authorities in the space. How much did that help, or did it even play a part in what would later become your role as a research analyst?
Well, you know, I think I'd certainly point out that I think that the way that I wrote my blog, which, you know, I appreciate you noting, and I do take care to make sure that what I'm not doing, and you know, frankly, too many bloggers do, is simply share a piece of information and then share an opinion of it and then draw some really big, important, and maybe unsubstantiated conclusions. I really go looking for, you know, what's underneath. I try not to buy the hype. And, you know, even our earlier discussion about sentiment, you know, goes to show that. I mean, it's easy to talk about how much sentiment is happening around snakes on a plane or, you know, how much money Dell made, but can you scratch beneath the surface and really find the true business benefit under all that? And I think, you know, I hope this doesn't sound too self-interested, but I think that's one of the reasons why they were interested in me at Forrester, is that my blog had demonstrated a certain research-like approach to blogging. But at the end of the day, the thing about a report is that it's not ultimately an opinion. You know, hopefully you are drawing some really interesting and eye-opening conclusions out of it. But one of the things a blog can be, and this is where I separated in my mind the difference between a blog post and a report, is that a blog can be an opinion. And many of my blog posts are opinions. Now, hopefully they are substantiated opinions. But, you know, I'll make some calls on the blog that I wouldn't necessarily make in a report, because we have to really substantiate some of the things that we're saying when we're Forrester. Now, that being said, one of the things I really respected about Forrester was that they really pushed this idea of making the call. They really want us to say something that is ahead of the curve. It doesn't do anyone any good at Forrester or our clients if all Forrester does is reflect what, you know, is actually happening and well understood. So they really wanted us to make the call, and they also understood that if they're going to push people to make the call, that sometimes they're going to be wrong. And they understood that their analysts were sometimes going to be proven wrong as time goes on, and that was okay as long as they were making a call and substantiating it. Still, I still think that's the difference from blog posts, which, you know, can be, you know, full of passion, they can be full of energy, they can be full of advocacy for one side of an issue, and they can be full of opinion. But I just would like to, with the blogging that I continue to do on experiencetheblog.com, is bring some sense of validity to the things that I'm saying. And so I'm going to continue to do lots of links within my blog to the data and information that inform the things that I blog about. But it's still a different experience than the report, and it goes beyond just the collaboration and the editing and the style. I just think that there's a difference in the reports that Forrester writes, because they're expensive, and they're expensive for good reason. A lot of time and care and energy goes into that, as opposed to a blog, which is free. And so, you know, when you get a Forrester report, you're getting something that somebody has spent a month or two on, and it represents, you know, possibly hundreds of hours, you know, at least dozens of hours, many dozens of hours. And it's a, you know, it's a huge investment. And you look at what's going on in the blogosphere, and sometimes people write things in 20 minutes and they're done with it. I love Seth Godin's blog, but, you know, he writes three pithy paragraphs and he's done with it. It probably takes him about 10 minutes to do. You know, what I tend to write takes me hours to do. But, you know, I'm not there simply to say pithy things and to inspire with, you know, a couple of quick thoughts. I'm really trying to dig into what's interesting with social media, what's working and what's not, and to hopefully cut through the hype.
Yeah, very different approaches. And, you know, I have to say, you know, in terms of the value, it's, you know, I certainly encourage everyone listening that haven't checked out your blog to certainly do so, because it is, I think, a very fine example of using using links to, you know, to really tell the story, because, you know, as we all know, there's plenty of examples out there that we can pontificate about, but it's almost like there's the commentariat, you know, that use the blog as sort of their way, use their blogs or whatever their platform is in social space as kind of a way of you know, trying to move the needle. And a lot of that feels today like sort of part of the personal brand, you know, and I wonder how much that will last as Gen Y comes in and they're, you know, personalities, generally speaking, are very, very different than X, which I think kind of, you know, a lot of us have X blinders on. And so to remind ourselves that there are other generations out there that are motivating, et cetera, and that's an important piece. I wonder, you know, I don't know if you can tell us the answer to this, and it you know, it's kind of a side point. You'd mentioned that you were a Forrester customer before. Will you be able to be a customer moving forward? Is that something you even know, or is that not part of your role at USAA?
Yeah, no, USAA is definitely a client, and I'm looking forward to continuing to listen. One of the things that I think can be addicting as an analyst is the access to the data that you have. You know, I know I'm going to be sitting in a meeting in 3 weeks at USAA, and, you know, it's going to be killing me that I don't have, you know, some piece of data about, you know, what percentage of moms over the age of 35 are playing social games, or something that I would just have had at my fingertips just a couple months early at Forrester. So I intend to be a really good Forrester client, actually.
Well, that's fantastic. That's nice to hear that it'll come full circle like that. And, of course, in the meantime, if you need that information, the Bunchball folks, behind gamification, I'm sure we'll be happy to help oblige to some extent. But as you said, you know, the at minimum dozens of hours for those that have seen a Forrester report know the depth, you know, and almost the daunting level of information that goes into that reporting. But at the same time, what I think is interesting about that role, and I think, you know, as we transition to towards the end of the program here, is you know, I think going to be interesting to see you in your new role. You know, obviously, you part of being a research analyst is being high profile because you're out there speaking a lot. And we had kind of, you know, talked about the pros and cons of, you know, being a research analyst, and none of the cons were, you're very, very, you know, honest, but, you know, none of the cons were sort of Forrester's terrible. It was more just, it's a lifestyle change. And, you know, one of the things you talked about was, you know, it just requires a lot of travel. So things like that, you know, what are the things that are going to change in your everyday life that you anticipate moving into this new chapter?
Well, you know, some of the cons, to be honest, are that it's very difficult from the work-life balance perspective. People do travel a lot. I didn't even travel. I think my travel was somewhat below average for a Forrester analyst. I only flew about 65,000 miles last year, which is, a good chunk. Yeah, well, and it's probably more than I've flown even when I worked at an agency with clients around the country in the last 5 years put together. But, yeah, I mean, that was one of the hard things about it. I know there's going to be some travel with USAA. There's already a discussion of flying out to L.A. to work with one of the agencies in a strategy session. And, you know, I'm not one of those people who, like, got tired of the travel. Some people, of course, just hate business travel. For all the hassles, I still had no problem with it. The only problem I had with it, and people who follow me on Twitter will know this to be true, is that I just think we've come to a point with laptops that and everyone having them that seats should not recline in airplanes, or at least there should be a non-reclining section, because one of the things I needed on this job was to use that airtime. It's, you know, that's a desk in front of you. You've got hours of uninterrupted opportunity to work on a report or work on a deck, and then somebody in front of me would lean back and suddenly I'd be unable to work. And so that was one of the frustrations that I brought with me. But so I think I'm going to be doing less travel. And I alluded to this earlier. One of the things that is exciting about Forrester, but also daunting, is the need to be an expert in so many different things. And I'm really looking forward to digging into USAA's challenge, to the opportunities they have with their very unique audience that they have. I used to work for almost a decade in financial services previously. I was at Northwestern Mutual, and this is going to be returned to an industry that I know pretty well. It's been many years since I've worked in it, but I'm excited about the return to that. And so those are some of the things that are going to be different. I'll tell you, you know, some of the things that I will both miss and not miss about Forrester. One of the things that people may not know about Forrester is that the people who are clients can have as many inquiries, which are 30-minute calls with analysts, as they wish. And I had days where I would get to work and open up my calendar, and I would have 4 straight hours of half-hour calls. And I will not miss a culture of half-hour meetings. I mean, on the one hand, it was very exciting. I met great people, and I would leap from one call to the next to have these just really exciting conversations, be able to impart some great data. I don't regret it at all, but it's exhausting. So I'm looking forward to being able to concentrate on working with my team, getting to know the people who are already running social media at USAA, finding out how I can help facilitate that. Really looking forward to understanding the challenges at USA and being able to take the time to get to know those challenges and opportunities rather than try to encompass the whole world. And that's one, something I'm really looking forward to. It's also going to be something I miss, but, that's the way it works, right?
Yeah, absolutely. One thing I wanted to ask you about was there's a military aspect to USAA, as I understand. Is that right?
Yep.
So how does that sort of, from what you can tell, how does that fit in terms of it being an organization that's generally in the financial sector but does have this, I would imagine the clientele is pretty specific to military families or individuals?
Well, one of the things that actually gives USA is an opportunity to focus on a given community. I mean, the people who grew up in military families share a common set of experiences. That gives you an opportunity to form a bond and have a community there, and not just a community from the standpoint of focusing on them as simply a customer audience. But one of the things that USA does is hire a lot of former military people. That's why it's in San Antonio. I believe, if I remember the statistics that were shared with me, that about 1 in 4 to 1 in 3 people who are hired at USAA are former military or from military families. And so what you see here is this opportunity to really create a sense of community, because the people who are providing the service and developing the products and marketing it are very much like the people in the audience. And so I think that's one of the exciting things about USAA is it's not a company that makes widgets and is going in search of a community to serve. It is a company that serves a community and has from day one, and that's why social media fits so well for it.
Yeah, I think there's such an opportunity, especially within, this time frame, is so kind of unique and special in terms of people returning or being redeployed to other areas and the resurgence in my lifetime anyway of kind of the military family, certainly having lots of needs, but, I can't imagine that financial is very far from the top of their list. So it seems, in a lot of ways, like it's a nice homage to the time and place that we live in to be transitioning into this role. I mean, a lot of people know me personally. I mean, I was a Peace Corps volunteer, and I felt like, I served my country, and that was my calling. But, the servicemen and women that, allow us to do these shows and be free, it's amazing. And to do anything that serves them, I would imagine, would feel to be, a great privilege to some extent.
I'm glad you say that. I do feel as if I'm going to a place, social media, first of all, but let me even step further back than that. In some respects, digital marketing through my career has been a calling for me, not just a career, not just something I do or something that I study or something, a professional one, but a real calling. I saw the web as something that was really going to, tear down some of the walls of companies and force them to be more open, both internally and externally. And in fact, that happened. I mean, you think about the way we interact on a daily basis inside organizations, and you think back to the days when we would type out memos and put them into envelopes, or if we wanted to talk to somebody, we'd have to talk to their assistant to get on their calendar. The web really did change the way organizations work, and to me that was a calling. And then social media came along, and that equally has been a calling. It changes the way we communicate. It changes the way we make decisions, and the way we design our products, the way we market. That, to me, is really exciting. And now, you know, as you point out, the USAA, I feel like there's a calling there. You know, we ask people who serve in the military to make these tremendous sacrifices. And it really bothers me that we are in a time of war, but nobody necessarily thinks of that. I mean, if you say the word time of war to somebody or wartime, you know, they're going to get in their mind something like the 1940s when huge sacrifices were made. And here it seems to me that we can take those sacrifices too much for granted. So if I can go to a company that, you know, successfully serves those needs and does so well that they, you know, have the highest net promoter score among that audience of any company in the U.S., then, you know, to me that's a great calling to sign on to. So I'm glad you mentioned that. I'm very excited about the opportunity.
Yeah, and I can't wait to hear more about that. I think, you know, it's something that gets understated and, you know, can't be said enough. We had President's Day this week. Many of our former presidents served in the military, and, you know, hats off to our armed forces, like I said, out there keeping us free in some of the more dangerous places in the world. I'll actually be heading out to Amman and eventually, well, Amman's very nice, Jordan, but Iraq eventually to be working with them on some training with both the Elections Commission and some other NGOs. And so myself and then Beth Cantor is actually going to be heading to Beirut. And people are saying, is it the same project? You know, there's certainly new frontiers to conquer, but, you know, obviously introducing technology and expertise that we may humbly have can do nothing but good. And I thank you so much for taking the time and your hugely busy schedule to move across country again to share your thoughts and some insights about what it's like to be behind the scenes as a research analyst, what it's like to get back into the financial sector with USAA, and to tell us about your blog and, you know, kind of hopefully for those that want to get into blogging and feel like it's having a resurgence these days, you know, give them some kind of pointers on what, you know, some of the ways that you can really add value rather than just pontificate.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. I've enjoyed it. And best of luck to you, Jennifer. We'll definitely stay in touch. We'll see you at South by Southwest, and I hope you get the opportunity to chat again.
Absolutely. Take care, Augie. I'm going to miss you in the area, but, you know, I'm glad your wife gets you back to some extent.
Thanks a lot, Jennifer.
Thanks so
take
much.
Care.
All right, bye take now. Care. And I thank you, the listeners of the A-List, for being active participants in the show. As you know, we crowdsource, and so we rely on your questions on Twitter, Facebook, and email to our guests. So I want to thank you for tuning in to the A-List with me, Jennifer Neely. And, of course, we hope you enjoyed the program. If you did, we'd love it if you'd be so kind as to friend us or add us to your favorites here on Blog Talk Radio or subscribe us. And please rate us on iTunes. We want to know what you think we're doing and, you know, of course, any suggestions on guests or topics that you'd like to see covered, please let us know. We want to be able to impart that to you. Later today, I'll be having a conversation with Carmen Scheidel, who's in charge of everything from events to education to multimedia content at Media Bistro about the upcoming social media marketing boot camp that Media Bistro is putting together, and they've so kindly asked me to be the conference leader for. And we have a lot of big names giving keynotes every week. It's a very different kind of conference. And today is the last day that you can use the discount and the last day of the early bird. So I want to encourage people, if you're interested at all, to head over to mediabistro.com/social media marketing bootcamp. And you can use the promo code JN, as in Nancy, 50, and get $50 off the early bird rate. And I think it's, you know, I've been part of the planning with Carmen, and I think we will have a great program for you to learn a lot of different aspects of social media. So I hope you'll take a look at that if you're so interested. Our next guest will likely be Chase McMichael from Infinigraph, which is actually a company that Augie had mentioned affinity, some of these words around social media monitoring, but basically affinities are the kinds of things that your customers and community may already like, and the things that we can tell based on the activities that they're undertaking on the web. And so hopefully we'll be able to connect with Chase rather soon to talk about that. And of course, for the latest on kind of everything and to get comments to me, best thing is probably Twitter. I'm Jennifer E.D. I made myself a verb. Or to get archives, information, archives of webcasts that I've done, et cetera, over at jenniferneely.com. I thank you so much for joining us. The program doesn't happen without you. And with that, I wish you a great day.